I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Dave Gary joins me now. The veteran television personality announced his retirement from broadcasting at the end of 2016. We'll reflect on a storied career, all those human interest stories that made him a household name in this town, first at CKVU and the various iterations that Channel 13 had, and the last 2.5 years at CTV Vancouver, where we reported on for their last word segment. He was last on this program in 2010. He had been let go from City TV after hosting the breakfast television broadcast and after some 20 years at the station. Since then, he went to Toronto to co-host Global's morning show before returning back to Vancouver and CTV in 2013. In 2015, he received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Radio Television Digital News Association. His blog, Manic Tapas, is at davegary.wordpress.com. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in person this time, Dave Gary. Mr. Gary, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Great.
How are you adjusting to retirement?
I love it. It's terrific.
It's all those things that they say it was?
Well, you know, especially when it comes to grandchildren. We have one grandchild now, and by the end of the year, we'll have more. And I spent all day yesterday just rolling around on the floor with him. You know, it's kind of like, when was the last time as an adult you hit the floor and roll around? Unless you're doing yoga, you're not down there.
Yeah.
And it really is, it's a cliche, but it's so true. The connection is so strong. And I just love him. He's just great, and he makes me feel 25 years younger.
That's what they say, that you have kids to have grandkids.
Yeah, well, I can see it now.
Yeah.
I see it now.
Yeah. You said in this piece that you wrote announcing your retirement that was on Facebook and various social media that this was your choice to leave.
That's right.
Yeah. There's been much bloodletting in journalism this past week, and it's a trend, newspapers, television, radio.
Mm-hmm.
One wonders why you didn't stay. Is it because of all that uncertainty?
You know, it was a very personal decision that I made, in that it just got, I found it very wearisome. I didn't enjoy the minutiae of the business. It got on my nerves. It's a hugely collaborative process. You have to work with editors, and you have to work with camera people, and I had a couple of individuals there that I would literally go into work because they helped make work for me. But otherwise, I just felt that I was tired. I was just too damn tired. I didn't want to do it anymore. And I didn't want to run my product into the ground for the sake of hanging on. I could have stayed there. They would have let me stay there. But, you know, twice a week, even at twice a week, I would wake up some mornings and I wouldn't know what I was going to do. Mm. And I felt that same panic. That internal panic and that scramble to find a concept that I thought would be worthy. Even if it was some goofy little knockoff anniversary International Waffle Day, it had to be something I hadn't done 100 times before, and I could bring some kind of little hook to it and maybe make it a little daring, a little provocative, a little naughty, just to give the anchors something interesting to comment on at the end of the newscast. And if I couldn't meet that bar, then I went home not feeling great about it. And I don't know, I just think we had always planned on early retirement, my wife and I, and we were in a position to do it, so I thought, well, why not? Time to go.
You know, when you talk about this panic, it's fascinating because I've watched you for years. I'm 34, so at least 30 years maybe, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I can remember you on UTV and Channel 13, whatever it was called at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember how, and even up to very recently on CTV, how easy you made it look. And so when you mentioned this panic or the this process that you would undertake to get that piece on the air that we saw and we enjoyed and laughed at or wept at, I mean, how do you explain that to someone who watches it and says, you made it look easy?
Well, I don't think you can. I think that making it easy is part of being so comfortable with the medium once you're in front of the camera, which, of course, is not natural for most people. But if you do it 40 years, it should be second nature. Mm. It's what precedes it. It's the my wife and I used to always talk about this, that it was, she said, I don't know how you do what you do, because to me it would be like not studying for a big exam, waking up the morning of the big exam and knowing that you were way behind the eight ball. And that's what I felt like a lot of mornings. And yet somehow you pull something out of a reservoir somewhere and go, okay, I can hang it on that and go. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't work. I remember when I used to be on with Frosty Forst on NW at 5 minutes to 8. And I did that, certainly didn't do it for the money. There was no money in it particularly. I did it for the audience because he was so hugely popular. Everybody listened to that show. Who wouldn't want that audience?
Yeah.
And so he gave me a wonderful opportunity, and I went on it for 2 years, Monday to Friday, 5 minutes to 8. And more often than not, I'd wake up at 7 o'clock, and I'd go, I don't have a clue what I'm going to talk about.
Really?
And it wasn't just that I had to fake it. I had to fake it by one of the smartest, sharpest guys in the business.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was always aware that he was probably sitting on the in downtown, downtown Vancouver going, oh, what's Dave trying to – what's he trying to slide by me here, you know? And he'd, more often than not, he'd call you on it.
Yeah.
But he was a very supportive guy.
Yeah.
And the market just missed him so much when he exited.
Yeah. I remember listening to you just before the major news to 8, and I'm surprised that you tell me this now, that at 7,
yeah.
You wouldn't know what you'd be saying
an
hour from now, or less than an hour from now.
No, so you know what? After a while, I think you just get fatigued.
Mm.
You get fatigued, and like I say, if you could step out gracefully in broadcasting, do it. Because there's way too many people that hang on past their best before date. And they know that target is growing on their back exponentially. People who disappear from the scene and are not given a great farewell and a goodbye are largely gone because of the money they made.
Mm.
It's all money. And now these decisions are not made at the local level. Well, they may be made as to which personnel go. But somebody in an office somewhere in another city on the 20th floor,
mm-hmm.
has got the ledger in front of them and goes, okay, let's tell them they've got to lose $250,000 worth of salary, and we don't care how they do it, in the next month. And they probably hand that decision off and down the line, and then there's some poor news director that's got to make that decision. Well, who do I let go?
Yeah. So you've been in a situation where that's happened to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we talked about this 7 years ago, when last time you were on. The outcry from the people in this town who love that show and loved you and Simi on that show.
Right.
Does that at all have an effect on management or the suits? No?
No. And people think it does.
Yeah. They tweet and they Facebook.
There'll be a groundswell of protest here and we'll move them. You don't move them because, there's a couple of factors at play. One is they all know that that'll die down after a while.
Mm-hmm.
People have short memories, and they'll take a short-term public relations hit for the long-term balancing of the ledger. And the other thing is that, frankly, in this new world of big telecommunications companies owning all the broadcasters, the managers are afraid for their jobs.
Mm.
There's no bold mavericks out there holding the line against this or that or, fighting people higher up in a big company.
Mm-hmm.
They can be exited just as quickly as anyone else. So I think that these decisions are made quickly and surgically and ironically in a business that touts itself as being very personal. And we want you to get used to these people and feel like they're part of your
and
family.
And transparent in some situations,
and
right?
then kaboom.
Yeah.
But we don't want you to think about that at the other end when we decide we have to take them off the air.
Yeah.
It's better to take yourself off the air if you can do it.
Yeah. You also wrote in this piece announcing your leave-taking that there isn't the money in production and travel that there was when you
There is no.
Yeah.
There's no money for production and travel.
So does that mean then that as a viewer – that I'm not as well served by the media in this town?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, reality TV is really what did in local production. Those kinds of shows, and I did many of them, documentaries and things like that, where you'd go out into the hinterland and sniff out some great characters and
you
things
went
like
sailing
that.
Sailing and around the world,
oh,
even? Yeah.
What was better than that? Yeah. That all got taken up by independent producers for specialty channels largely and decided that's where all that programming kind of went, And people started shooting their own stuff, like Les Stroud and these people. They're not even news cameramen anymore.
Yeah.
So those were glory days, And I really consider that to be a real sweet spot in my career, kind of in the 90s where there was money for local production.
Mm-hmm.
Stations had to spend it in order to for their promise of performance to maintain their license. And if you were if you could diversify yourself and jump through enough hoops, you were of great use to them. So I had a great little run there, but then it just almost disappeared overnight. So it's too bad, because I don't think there's any point in a guy my age, I'm 63, telling some kid out of BCIT who's got his first job in television that you missed out on the great days of local production. That doesn't matter to them. They have no frame of reference for it. You can't miss what you never knew.
Yeah.
But I think for older guys like me, we know how much fun that was and how it all just dried up to the point where now you had your minute and a half story and that was it.
Yeah.
It didn't matter how compelling the pictures were or the character. There's no way you can get it past a minute and a half, basically.
Yeah.
And it's too bad because some stories deserve the time to breathe.
So do you run into people who say to you, you know, I like what you do. I want to do that for a living.
Yeah.
And so what do you tell them?
I tell them it doesn't exist anymore. Well, and now you can do it yourself. You can do it on the computer.
Yeah.
You can do your own little series and put it on YouTube and get 100,000 hits in 10 minutes. You could never do that in conventional broadcasting. So the goalposts have really moved. It's really like comparing apples and oranges. There's no point in bemoaning it. I'm just grateful that I got it. I would have liked to have gotten into television, I think, if I'd been born earlier, to have gotten into it in the 50s, in the 60s, when every local TV station had a game show and a kids show and a movie show. And, I mean, that would have been the soupy sales days. That would have been wild to be in that. But I just got the tail end of it, which was good for me. Yeah, so I have nothing but good memories.
Yeah. Dude, so when you were growing up, were there people? Because I just mentioned that people must come to you for advice, wanting to say emulate whatever you've done with your career. Were there people that you looked to that inspired you or that you wanted to emulate? Say,
well, certainly once I got into broadcasting, I took a look at the few mavericks in the field who had carved themselves that little personal niche where they could do those little character pieces. It was part editorial, but it was and part personal, but also hooked onto an interesting character or place. And I thought, that's where I want to go. I don't want to do hard news. Hard news was way too much work.
But you did some of that with the CBC and CTV and
I did that for
Ontario.
10 years back east. Just to learn your craft, right?
So then when you come out here at Channel 13.
Yes, 1985.
Did you do hard news here in the sound?
No.
Oh, you just did
I was hired to write comedy for the Vancouver show.
Right.
Which was almost in its death throes. It was called Vancouver Live.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of producers from Los Angeles, whom Daryl Duke, the station owner, had put in place to try and revive this show because his ratings were flagging.
Who was hosting it when you came in?
Wayne Cox, Maria LaRose, Laurier LaPierre, Dave Kincaid was there as well.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I was only in town 8 weeks, and then the station went on strike.
Mm.
So I felt like a schmuck. I thought, well, I've just moved my family all the way across the country and blindly walked into a labor dispute. That was wicked bad.
Strikes. We don't hear those anymore.
No.
We're about those anymore.
No.
you go into, I guess you watched a lot of TV too growing up.
Right? Sure.
Yeah. And so were there people that you like, sort of like Charlie Carroll. I mean, did you like him? And I mean, that's the only thing.
I loved Charles Carroll.
Yeah, that's the only thing I can think of that's akin to the stuff that you did.
But, you know, I lived in southern Ontario, which, of course, as we know, juts down into the United States and is majorly covered by big American stations out of Detroit, out of Cleveland, out of Buffalo. Those signals all beamed across the lakes, and so you would watch. A lot of these guys were like horror show hosts and afternoon movie style guys and cartoon characters. And even that little station I eventually worked at in Kitchener, Ontario, was a powerhouse of programming. CKCO, they did Romper Room for the National Network. They had a a guy that had a cartoon show named Big Al, who was a big guy that, hosted a thing called Cartoon Capers, and Big Al had a big white Stetson, and you know, and they had a polka show. I mean, this is where SCTV got the Schmengi brothers. They got them from Walter Ostenak, Canada's polka king, who had his own show there. They had Bowling for Dollars. They had all these things, and you'd sit in the cafeteria sometimes. It was like the Mary Tyler Moore show, and you'd be sitting there with Oopsie the Clown and Big Al in his Stetson and Miss Fran from Romper Room, and you'd be going, wow, this is nutty. I got a little taste of that much, much later on at CKVU when it reincarnated itself as UTV. And I was working on a show called You Tonight with people like Chris Hebb. And Mike Hall was producing the show. And we had a great general manager by the name of Peter Viner who came down and he said, okay, girls, to the guys, I don't want you guys to be afraid to say anything on television. There's no restrictions here. Just go nuts. So we did. And there were certainly times on that show where I thought, I mean, you're spinning plates or something in the studio, and we got a potbelly pig with antlers on it drinking out of a giant bowl of eggnog while the bagpiper here. And then we had Tracy Bell, a great talent in town. She's doing her Cher impression. And I'm going, this is lunacy. And I don't really care who's watching it. I just want to drink it in because this is a throwback to those great old days of Anything Goes.
Yeah,
right? So as I say, I certainly had there was a lot of pressure there to produce programming. You couldn't dry up, or if you did, you had to fight your way through it. But I also knew it was a sweet spot that wasn't going to come again.
You mentioned Big Al, and you've told me before that you grew up watching him, and then when you're there in Kitchener, you get to work with him.
Right.
And he was much older than you were, right?
Right.
And years later, people know this, that when you worked at Channel 13, your desk mate was a girl who was just out of college, out of Langara.
That's right.
And you guys hit it off. And
we sure did.
And you're still friends today and had great chemistry on there, Simi Sarah.
Yeah.
What is it about connecting with people that you're able to do and do so well? Because, I mean, I know that of you from stories we've shared, but you know, you saw that on TV when you're talking to people on the street.
I know. Well, I think I assume a familiarity that isn't there. That's the first thing I do. And then your experience by looking at them tells you whether they're willing to play along, whether they'll embrace that concept that, oh, we're going to talk like we're old friends and we'll kibitz and we'll josh each other and maybe insult each other. And I mean, that's a little assessment that almost gets made in a microsecond after you connect with them. And if they're standoffish or whatever, then you let them go. That's another thing that I got pretty tired of. The Streeter thing could make you or break you. If you had a great one, you felt on top of the world. But there's a lot of rejection up there. A lot of people that don't even... Excuse me, ma'am, could I ask you a question? They don't even look at you. They walk by like you're a Mooney or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I used to get angry. I got increasingly angry when people wouldn't even stop to talk. Why should they talk to me? They're not obligated. But I still took it very personally, and then I thought, oh, you're just getting too bitter and grumpy.
But that's, I guess, our culture nowadays. We're all looking at our phones and
But we're also used to being on camera. Yeah. From every angle, you'd think people would be more embracing. I used to love running into a group of New Yorkers, especially, because they were so inherently gregarious. It was like being in a Neil Simon comedy, instantly.
Yeah.
And you'd go, thank you, Lord, for sending these people down the sidewalk at just the right time.
Yeah.
So I did the last piece I did for CTV on December 30th when I retired was to just go out on the street and talk about how that really had made me feel the best and the worst, you know.
So when we would see the 2 minutes or so that you would produce for the end of the newscast, how long would that take?
To shoot?
Yeah.
Well, if you couldn't get it in half an hour, you probably weren't going to get it.
Yeah.
And with more and more years, I was able to pare it down and be quite economical with how much we had to shoot to get what I wanted. And sometimes there are concepts that just do not get up and go. They just don't. Yeah. You've convinced yourself, you've deluded yourself to thinking, this is brilliant. Wait till I take this out on the street. People are going to go crazy for this concept. Yeah. And it just lays there. And you look at the cameraman and you start laughing because you know you've got a turkey.
Yeah.
You either have to, you got to switch gears. You have to switch gears and find something else or try and turn something into something, something bad into something good, right?
Yeah.
Turn a lemon into lemonade. That's what I'm going for. And maybe do it on the fact that, look, we tried to do this, but you people didn't want to play. It's possible to do that, turn a negative into a positive. Well, we should talk more about Simi Sarah, you know.
Oh, isn't she marvelous? I listen to her from time to time on the radio, and her gifts as a communicator they just radiate through the
such a great
microphone.
Old soul. That's what I liked about her.
Yeah.
They plunked her down beside me, and I was a reputation of being a kind of a grumpy guy. And they said, "Don't put the intern next to Dave." Well, you know, we did connect, and we worked. We had such great conversations at the desk that I knew if we could get that on the air, that would be an asset. So when Chum bought the station from Global and launched it as City TV, we went upstairs and we told management. We said, "We're your morning show people. We've got it down. We've been doing it for years. We're just not on the air." But they had their own ideas. Oh, no, we got this person and that person, and Moses Neimer was involved in it. And I'm going, oh, Lord. So eventually it took years before a guy named Bud Pierce, whom I think was the most talented producer of television in the country, came out to Vancouver and saw Simi and I filling in for people who were away and called us into his office and said, "I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you people do the show?" Yeah. And we said, "Of course we'd do the show. We've been telling them here for years."
Yeah.
And so Bud is the guy that put Simi and I on the air. And that's how I ended up in Toronto. Because Bud had been hired by Global to relaunch a morning show.
I guess they didn't have a morning show in Toronto.
No. And they wanted a new 7-year license, and they were basing this license upon these morning shows they were going to launch in Toronto and Edmonton and everywhere. So he phones me up and he goes, and I've always felt that I had not worked with him long enough before both he disappeared and Simi and I disappeared. And I wanted another crack at it. And I said to my wife, "Here's something interesting." At that time, I was working for TELUS. Simi and I were both working for TELUS. TELUS had to do programming in order to carry the cable. But though that was filled a hole, it didn't broadcast generally, and it didn't nourish you as a broadcaster particularly. So I thought, well, this is the big apple for me, Toronto, and here's the guy I want to work with. And I asked my wife, and she said, I think you should do it. I can't go with you. I'm looking after my mother, whose health is failing. It is in her late 80s at the time. But we'll do the WestJet conjugal visit, and you get yourself a furnished apartment in Toronto. And so Global built a new studio right at Yonge and Bloor. And I went there, and I met Liza Frommer, who I was going to co-host the show with, and Chris Reyes and Deru Dillon. I mean, Joseph, I walked into that. We had a couple of dinners, Bud did. And I sat down at the table, and I'm going to tell you this, the women were beautiful. The women were knockouts. And I looked across the table at Bud, and I thought, what are you doing here? And why do you want me? Because those Global guys, first of all, I don't think I'd ever heard of me. And thought, why does he want to bring this old coot from the West Coast here?
Because all of those women were on other, like Liza was on Breakfast Television in Toronto when it was number one, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And Bud had created Breakfast Television in Toronto. So that was a format he was familiar with. But he wanted to do something different. He wanted four, what he thought were intelligent people around a desk, almost like The View, but not quite like The View, to talk about issues of the day. Yeah. He didn't want it to be a typical morning show.
Yeah.
And so I convinced myself that I should grab it, and I should go to Toronto, and I should do it because, as Angie, my wife, said, I don't want to hear for the rest of your life that you should have done it.
Mm.
So I went, but I learned some really important lessons when I was there. The first thing that happened was, after Bud's contract had run out, his consulting contract, they didn't keep him.
Mm.
They let him go. Now, the whole reason for me going to Toronto had just disappeared. And I got progressively grumpy on the air, I guess. I wasn't very good at covering it. Mm. The show lapsed into, out of Bud's concept, into what I thought was really everyday pablum of morning shows. Fashion shows, cooking segments, let's talk about Justin Bieber for 10 minutes, let's talk about Oprah Winfrey for 10 minutes. Who wore what on the red carpet at the Grammys, and aren't the Fascinators interesting? I mean, it was just what I didn't want to do anymore.
Mm.
And I did not hide my disdain for it to the point where eventually I knew they were going to take me off that show. And they did, but they gave me an out. They said, look, rather than you go back to Vancouver, why don't you go into our newsroom here at Global, because we like it when you do the occasional feature here.
Mm.
We think you're a good writer. And I thought, for 6 months, yeah, I think I'll do that.
And that's, so you would do the work that you were known out here for, right?
That's right. So yeah. I went into the Global newsroom in Toronto, came off the morning show. I did 6 months of reporting for them. And then there was a change in salary expectation at that stage. And I said, okay, I'm all done now.
Mm.
Thanks. And came back. And by the way, I don't recommend taking a two-year separation, particularly in your marriage. I don't think that's a very useful thing in the long run. The first thing it teaches your wife is that she can largely live without you.
and you can't live without her, right?
Well, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that was probably had outlived its usefulness. And then I was kind of recruited by CTV before I left Toronto, because I had heard I was coming back.
Yeah.
Here anyway, and what would I think about doing a couple of days a week at their station? And they had Mike McArdle. You know, this is coincidental that Global had let Mike McArdle go at exactly
right.
The same time.
Yeah.
So I think they thought they could grab two guys that were pretty well known on a part-time basis, pool them together into one solid segment at the end of the newscast.
Yeah.
And so why wouldn't you want to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did the needle move? Did the numbers, I mean...
Well, yes, I think that I was told that that was a pretty strong segment and was holding people past the half hour at the bottom at 6:30, which is very hard to do because people wanted to see that. Then that segment became sponsored.
Mm. Brought to you by, and yeah. when you hear that on TV, you know that there's money involved. And
you see this increasingly now. Look at all the little segments of
the weather brought to you by.
The helicopter. The helicopter's brought to you by somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, we're joking that eventually the anchors will be sitting there like Indy drivers.
With patches on.
Yeah, Valvoline. The news brought to you by Valvoline. You know, I just think that's the way that they're going to try and mine more income. In an industry where advertising revenues are declining.
So your years at CTV here in Vancouver, I mean, those were, you liked being back in town, right? And you like, I mean, when you would film those streeters, people would say, hey, Dave, how are you?
Yeah, I
that was nice, right?
I don't want to be anti-Vancouver, but this is a town I've never felt completely connected to.
Hmm.
I didn't grow up here. I was never under the impression this is the only place on God's green earth you should live. When all these surveys come out saying it's the most livable city, I would always chuckle because we know the problems here.
Right.
Which, and I think it's increasingly become an exclusionary city. I mean, I live on the other side of the Portman Bridge. I have to pay a fee just to come and visit this city. So I drove in today to talk to you in your studio. And I don't drive into Vancouver very often, being out in the burbs. And I'll tell you, it's stressful.
Yeah.
It's nutty. The congestion at 11 o'clock in the morning is almost rock solid. I don't see how this is going to get any better.
You left for a spell to go to Toronto.
Yeah.
And then you
came
back.
But I walked
there.
Everywhere in Toronto.
Yeah.
I lived right downtown. I lived in the annex.
Yeah.
It was great. But I was living in a basement apartment. I felt like I was in university again, cursing the people walking around
at night. Yeah.
Yeah, above me and letting their dogs run around. And it was that was a very strange experience. I'm glad I did it. But I'll tell you, I've always been a good writer right out of high school. I knew that was my strength. Yeah. And that's why I went into journalism. I also loved the theater, so I thought, oh, this allows me to combine a little performance with the writing.
Yeah.
When you stray into this, when you have a strength like being a good reporter or a writer, and you stray into that host role in television, you are literally putting a big target on your forehead and asking everybody to take a shot at you. And they do. Suddenly you're being judged on appearance. Yeah. Every nuance of everything you say is subject to criticism. And I should have, in hindsight, just stayed in the reporting realm. But you know, you get seduced by the money. Mm. The money is so much better as a host. And the attention is so much greater. It's very egotistical. But you do so at your peril.
And when you you talk about the criticism that one would get online, say, I mean, it must be 10 times worse for women on the air.
Oh, it's wicked for women.
Yeah.
Absolutely wicked for women. I don't, you know, well, how can I put this? Yes. You know,
people criticize it, just, you know, the color of the outfit, let alone what the outfit
or the hairstyle.
Or,
my
wife
does that. She sits beside me on the couch and she goes, "Oh, what's she doing with her hair?" I said, "Angie, can't we get past her hair? You've been married to a guy who's been in broadcasting 40 years. You must know there's more than just hair." But you know what? Hair is a big piece of it.
Yeah,
hair is really a big piece of it. As shallow as that sounds. So.
In your years in broadcasting, and we've talked about previously about connecting with people on the street and talking to them, do you understand people a little bit better having done the work that you've done these past 40 years? I mean, do you understand why people do the things that they do, especially when you think of recent news, you know, the bad stuff?
Like what?
Oh, people shooting up things. And I mean, do you understand people... And what motivates them in doing what they do?
I mean, well, I think a guy like Mike McArdle probably understands that better than me. Because Mike would go, when Mike goes to the street, Mike really goes to the street. Like he goes to the gutter part of the street sometimes, where he finds and tells these compelling stories about people that are really down and out and tries to bestow upon them some measure of dignity and personality and individuality. I must say, I tended to play it fairly safe that way. You know, I wasn't necessarily trying to find people. I would talk to a lot of eccentrics mm-hmm. in my career. But these were people who were, if they were slightly off, were aware that they were off. They weren't oblivious. If they were eccentrics, they knew they were eccentric. And they celebrated it, and they reveled in it. And that's why they collected cast iron frying pans or refrigerator magnets or fire trucks or whatever it is they collected.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they became the way they became. So I don't know if I understand the human – you're asking about the human condition.
Yeah, or just because you talked a moment ago about people in this town not stopping to talk to you even if you have a camera.
Right.
I mean, let alone someone who's asking for money, say.
Mm.
Does that give you any insight into how we are as people, or how we are as Vancouverites, even just?
Well, I don't know why we're so casual in one respect, but we're so locked up in another respect. In Toronto, I found people better dressed on the street. They weren't all in Lululemon wear and North Face jackets. And so it was not as much of a leisure culture.
Mm.
It was more of a down-to-business culture. But I found that they would talk to you more readily on the sidewalk. Whereas here, people who look like they're more lackadaisical and more casual would sometimes be the hardest to get to engage. And I'm not quite sure why that dichotomy exists. I don't know if it's cultural. It could be partly cultural. I don't know. I don't think I've got any deep explanations for that. Other than the fact that people certainly feel, I mean, they may think you're rude by intruding into their space as they're walking down the sidewalk, but boy, there's a lot of rude people out there too.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had people go after me on the sidewalk too and tell me I'm taking up the whole sidewalk and get off the sidewalk. Like they own the sidewalk. and I would tend to get, if they pushed me, I'd push back.
Because we're all talking about the future of this town, and we're talking about how livable this place is. How do you think this story ends?
Gee, I don't know, because my children certainly can't afford to live in Vancouver. And I doubt my grandchildren will be able to afford to live in Vancouver. People are already leaving for new opportunities because the economics just don't make any sense. You've got, is it going to become a city full of billionaire bicycle riders? Is that the final aim? I don't know. People can't pay their taxes. Yeah. They've lived in a home for 50 years, right? Suddenly here's the new assessment. They can't afford to pay their taxes. I don't know. I think it's a city that has largely relied upon its geographic and topographic beauty. But when you look around at it, I'm not that enamored with it. I mean, I know people will take offense at that, and I'm sorry if you're dyed-in-the-wool Vancouver lover and you think this is the only place. But I wouldn't want to live here right now in town. I need a little more room to roam than this.
Yeah.
It's just too congested. There's too many pedestrians. There's too many cars. There's just too many trucks. It used to be a big joke for me and a cameraman to be shooting downtown because it was so damn noisy. You couldn't get a quiet moment.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. If you're coming from a congested culture and you move into Vancouver, it may seem like it's not as congested.
Quaint.
Yeah, or quaint. But I think this is a function of age. I don't think once you get over the age of 60, you're looking for, you got to be where all the action is. You got to be where all the theaters are and all this kind of stuff. And you know, I don't know where to downsize to now. I don't want to move away from my family, certainly, or my grandchildren. But where do you go? Where do you go? Everyone's saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Where do you go? If the city was more accommodating and reasonable and those economies made sense, people wouldn't be asking this question as much.
But I think they're asking that in every big city.
Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
We're always looking for the next, where we're headed or whatever, right?
Right.
Yeah. So other than entertaining your grandchildren, as you do regularly, what do you fill your days with now?
I fill my days with baking bread, painting, and when we get into gardening season, gardening. I mean, I have a lot of things I like to do. I'm a bit like my dad. My dad was into everything.
Yeah.
And I think that that will give me a great, rich, whatever I've got left. I think what happens to a lot of broadcasters is they put so much of themselves into the profession that when the profession, they leave the profession or it leaves them, they're at a loss. They don't know what to do with themselves. They've come to be defined by that person who was on the air. They've developed no other interests. They don't have any other acquaintances outside of those in broadcasting. I think those people are really just adrift. And I think that's why a lot of them hang on forever and ever and ever. You know?
Is it a great lesson in Carson that he was just at the top of his game? I think he was 63.
Yeah.
Out, and he never came back. Is it something that you're, I mean, you never say never?
Well, I would never say never, but I mean, so you say a year from now, am I going to be craving a creative outlet? Not necessarily. I think if you've got other creative outlets, if you're into art, I don't know. There's lots of other ways you can express yourself. And if you're a writer, you probably still have to write. There's a part of me that thought that I would try and do a little stage thing. I wonder if I could do like a little one-man show. Not that anyone would care what I had to say or that I'm the size of a personality that could, whose name recognition would sell that. But what could you put together for a 40-minute or 45 minutes on stage that you could talk about that people would find entertaining and amusing and informative?
Sit there with and then open up the newspaper. And
if know. There's any newspapers left.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I don't know. There's maybe a germ in there somewhere, but I don't feel compelled to do it right now. You mentioned my blog. I haven't contributed to the blog in so long, I feel like I've neglected it. And so maybe that'll be
some marvelous writing there, as I've told you before.
Thank you. So there's another place where I think maybe I can go to if I feel I really am compelled to do it. But right now, I really am enjoying being lazy, not having the panic feeling about knowing where the concept's coming from. There are certainly some people I miss in broadcasting.
Yeah.
and I miss seeing them on a weekly basis, but I know they're sitting there wondering when they're going to get the tap on the shoulder too. And the tap on the shoulder comes for all who are there.
It just sounds like a dreadful business, but I mean, at the same time, it is. But at the same time, there are these rewarding moments that you've been accustomed to throughout your career, right?
I feel so grateful that I had 40 pretty good years of doing more or less what I wanted to do and danced around enough to survive for that amount of time and didn't have to kind of suddenly become like a realtor or a politician or try and fire up a PR company or something in order to salvage what I thought was going to be a long-running career. If you're coming out of broadcast school now and you think you're going to get a 30-year run in conventional broadcasting, I think that's a dream. I don't think it'll be there. If it'll be there, it'll be in a form that I can't imagine now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. What do you say to the viewers? Because, I mean, you've a lot of fans over the years who've loved the work and have followed you from 13 to Channel 9. And
well, what can I say except thanks so much for watching. I'm sorry if I insulted your intelligence at times because there was some really questionable, awful, when I look back on it now in hindsight, awful, desperate stuff we put on TV because we thought it was funny or at least we had to fill the time. And if you saw one of those and were insulted or... I apologize, but again, it came out of good intentions, and I do run into people that thank me for the work that I did and that I added something to their enjoyment of the medium, and that means an awful lot when you hear that. Yeah, you never take that for granted.
Just think of all the smiles that you gave people at the end of their day. You know.
Yeah. Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so. But yeah, there'll be others. Yeah. I don't know who they'll be, but they're going to have to get out there and craft that niche themselves because no one's going to hand it to them.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you had a piece just before you retired in December sometime where you had all these things in your house, all these gags, and you had these awful-looking tuxedos.
Right.
And you still fit in them. I mean, how does that happen?
Well, I guess I'm whatever that body style is. There's no heavy people in the Gary family.
Really?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so. So I think that's a function of stress. I tell you. You know, I kind of was my own worst enemy that way. I think anxiety kept my weight off.
And that added to, I guess, your abilities and your talents too,
sure.
Right?
You know? You know. If you were the kind of person that didn't get upset over tiny little details of life, you couldn't have done half of what I did.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'll turn that prop box over to my grandchildren, and they can fool around in it at Halloween or say, why has Grandpa got so many rubber false noses and things?
Or a chicken.
Groucho glasses.
And, yeah.
Yeah, the rubber chicken that fell apart.
Yeah. This has been delightful.
Oh, thank you.
And I so appreciate you coming in to do this. And we've talked over the years, but this is the first time we've met face to face. And I appreciate you coming, paying the toll to come in here.
Well, thanks for putting me on for perhaps my last time. Who knows?
Oh, people can go to davegary.wordpress.com, and there'll be something there, won't there?
I hope so.
There's got to be, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, now that I'm completely unfettered, I don't have to worry about, you don't want to get sued, but you know what I mean. I mean, you feel a certain liberation where you're not always watching your back or stepping on certain people's toes. And to all my friends who are still in broadcasting, Godspeed and good luck and watch your back.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Joseph.
Dave Gary joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.